discussing the ideas, the challenges, and the technology of the crypto economy. This is a Crypto Economy Chat. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the Crypto Economy Podcast. I am Guy Swan, your host. And we are going to do... I had planned on reading today, but two things happened. One is my... I kind of lost my voice a little bit last night. I'm sure I could still get through reading something, but if I could avoid it, I'll take that option. My wife and I actually found out there was a 21 Pilots concert in the area, and that was like 2 or 3 days ago, and so just kind of on a whim, decided we were going to get tickets at the last minute and go. And because of that, I did quite a bit more yelling at the top of my lungs than I usually do on a Tuesday night. But luckily, Jared, who... Thank you, Jared, if you end up listening to this. A shout out to him for bringing all of his equipment and working the sound for us at the Raleigh Bitcoin meetup. Because we did we decided to just kind of out of nowhere throw together a podcast episode. We decided we were going to try to record the conversation and sit down with, I can't remember, I guess it was like 6 people we had technically on the mics. At least like 5 or 6 that we had like making comments, and had a really fun conversation all about privacy. Just privacy in general, its importance. What does Bitcoin mean for privacy? How does privacy affect Bitcoin? And then just kind of this whole new world, this new ecosystem, this new crypto economy being built, that is a very different place than the world we're coming from. There's a major transition happening. And we talked all about all of this and what we think it means for privacy and what privacy implications mean for it. So I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. We had a lot of fun, and I think I want to keep this up. I think I want to try to... do this again maybe once a month or something, and just kind of get the crew together and have ourselves a conversation about Bitcoin. And with that, actually, before we jump into it, I also want to announce I'm starting a Q&A. It's going to be an Ask Guy episode that I think I'm going to try to do maybe once a month as well, maybe once every 2 weeks. I'm not sure. I want to kind of feel it out and see what kind of participation we get to start with. This will be a great place that you guys can just drop me some questions. I think I'm going to make maybe its own page on the podcast, and I'm planning to actually do video with this one. So I'm just going to come at you from a Bitcoin blankie fort and answer any questions or comments or anything that you guys have. This will also be another great use for the voice messages. I got a voice message from Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, which was a comment on one of the episodes sometime back. And so this will be a great way that you can either drop comments that I could use in the Q&A section, or obviously questions, like anything you want me to, even if it's something you want me to read or check out, like that's always really appreciate those, suggestions as well. But I intend to do, I currently have this scheduled, and I'm not sure, I think I might be able to do this one live on YouTube. I've considered doing that. I'll probably do a recorded one just so I can kind of get the feel for it, like the first time or two, and then just post it to YouTube and then a podcast episode. But I think I'm going to do that. Currently have that scheduled for 9 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday the 19th. So it'll be next Wednesday, 1 week from today. I know if I do it live, I'll probably have to pick a better time. I imagine most people wouldn't be available then. But let me know what your thoughts on that are, if you wanted to do it live. And we'll start from there. And throw me some questions. Shoot me a voicemail or a voice message on Anchor, and or shoot me an email at thecryptoeconomy@pm.me. All right, I think we got all that out of the way. Let's go ahead and jump in. And just so you know, we really just started recording in the middle of a conversation, and so there's not much of an intro here, but we do get to that eventually. But let's just start right off with where we started recording.
All right. Does hyper Bitcoinization depend on privacy? Like, if we don't get privacy and fungibility, is hyper Bitcoinization still possible? I think that's a good question.
I'm going to say no. I don't think so. Because if we don't value privacy, then what's the value of Bitcoin at the end of the day? Right. Are we just using it as a cash, you know, system? I mean, it's got to be some privacy element that we want to take home with us, right? I'm going to say no.
I kind of feel like privacy in general, like, I think it's kind of in the nature of, if Bitcoin is independent, decentralized, and programmable, privacy is always a possibility. So I think it's really to ensure that the nature of the system makes privacy a potential end, and the fact that we are losing it kind of in this day and age, I think, has only increased. I mean, like, the push for privacy is stronger than I feel like it ever has, because the need to make sure it stays around is basically more prevalent than it's ever been in history. Because in the last 20 years, the game has changed massively. And like now, like, we've kind of changed this. The conversation used to be, you know, like, you had to have a good explanation to invade someone's privacy, because it took a lot of work to invade someone's privacy in the physical world. But in the digital world, the default is no privacy. So now the conversation has changed to, I need a good explanation as to why I want it back. And like, I think that inherently is a really bad shift that has happened. And I think Bitcoin is a huge step into, like, turning that question back around. I think we will get privacy at the base layer, and I think it is, like, critically important. So I think the nature of privacy, the nature of Bitcoin, will allow privacy, like, end of story, and we'll have it because of that. So I think they just kind of go hand in hand. Like, I think, yes, in a sense, privacy is critical. Like, Bitcoin will not succeed without privacy, but because of the way it is, I think it's going to be there eventually.
Do you see that, like, that's happened slowly, like, the giving up of our privacy? Do you think that's, like, just been a gradual degradation over, like, a century? Or do you think more of that's happened recently?
I think it's definitely accelerated. I think it's one of those things that's like an exponential trend. You know, like, you lay the groundwork for 80 years, and then, like, 20 years of development hits, and, like, after you have this new layer, like, networks were a great example of just, like, the birth of so many networks. Like, we kind of became a networked organism in, like, almost overnight, it seems like, in the whole grand scheme of things. And, like, that just completely opened up to all the pressures and the desire to invade other people's privacy that are just consistent. Like, the barriers to do so just got smaller and smaller and smaller. And it's really, like, the last 20, 30 years is where the bulk of it happened. But I think it was a normal trend.
I think you had a good analogy where you said, you know, before, it was physical. In the physical realm, it's hard to, like, invade someone's privacy. You got to, you know, break into someone's home, you know, beat them up, you know, completely subdue somebody to take what they have. In the digital world, do we have those same elements? Do we have those same defenses? Not really. We just hand them off to, like, a Google, like a Facebook, or one of those guys, and say, hey, you defend me. Or Chase Bank or Bank of America, right? Like, hey, you guys defend me. At that point, it's like, okay, you're no longer in charge of defending yourself. So when those guys do go down, what happens to the individual? I think is going to happen where we've seen the breaches already, right? When more of those happen, people are going to start realizing, like, hey, I need to take matters into my own hands, right? I need to properly defend myself like I used to do back in the day, like in the physical realm. I'm going to protect my home. And I'm going to do that in the digital space as well. I'm going to protect my keys, right? Like my money, I'm going to protect it. I'm not letting Bank of America or some Joe Schmo down the block protect it for me. This is mine. Yeah. So
I think when we have a situation where value becomes purely digital, like the nature of everything changes, like your frame of reference, like what is possible in the digital realm changes drastically. I think there's a huge effect on the mindset in that way. And kind of the reason we lost privacy, I see it more of as a transition phase, is that we've lost it because we're not used to the new environment that we've created. We don't know how it works. Like you say, like we're trusting Bank of America or Chase Bank or whoever it is to protect our privacy and to secure us. Coming from somebody who like has the perspective and knows exactly what kind of information you're giving those people and like how vulnerable you are, I think 95% of the people don't know. Like they don't even think about the fact that they're relying on Chase to protect them, that they're relying on Google to protect them. They're just doing business as usual and forgetting that the effects of what they do is very different in the digital than in the physical. It's a poor habit translation. They're taking bad habit or decent habits from the physical world that are actually really bad habits and really bad ways of thinking about things in the digital. So I think it will end up swinging back the other way, and I think we're seeing that. I think Bitcoin is a huge part of that. But right now it's just really crappy, and until the trend changes, it's just going to keep looking nastier until it starts to shift back, I think.
I think it's interesting. You know, you talked about physical privacy. If somebody invades your physical privacy, you don't really get anything. But with technology, I get to update my friends on where I'm at. And yet it's an invasion of my privacy as well. So, you know, I'm downloading that new app. That's great technology. And I can update everybody and share with my friends. And then I'm also realizing, oh, yeah, anybody who's a developer at Facebook has access to that information. So I think with Bitcoin, we're getting this new technology, but we're also getting privacy, or at least the option for it.
Yeah, I think, you know, people, there's a fear element to this as well. Like I know in previous meetups, we talked about how Bitcoin just does a good job of just manifesting adversarial natures of human beings. Like, just look at the mining process with, you know, how it manifests greed, right? All these greedy people trying to get all these Bitcoin rewards through blocks, right? I think in a different dimension when it comes to what we deal with, like with governments or big companies, corporations, we're dealing with fear. They're manifesting fear. So they're saying, hey, you know, you can't protect this stuff.
Who's got the fear? The corporations or the government? They're afraid? Is that what you're saying?
No, they're not afraid. Well, they could be afraid, yes, but they're making us afraid, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
They're telling us, hey, you should be afraid because you have, you know, $50, right? And someone could take that $50 from you. Let me hold your $50. It's like that. So from that standpoint, it's like, okay. One like you were saying. Once these corporations start going down, whether it's by breaches or whatever, you know, they're just not able to handle the scale of all this data that they're protecting, then people will start realizing, like, hey, maybe I shouldn't have really trusted you so much to you know, handle my precious money, right? So, but yeah, privacy, someone wrote down, should the rights of privacy be an amendment? I think that should be an amendment for sure, right? We should definitely fight for it because right now it's being taken away from us by the dozen. Like, it's serious. It's a war on privacy.
I like how he changed that. Should digital right to privacy be an amendment?
We should point out that we have like 8 people in the room, and random people are just writing things down on the whiteboard right now.
I know. We just rolled into this. All right, so this is the Raleigh Bitcoin crew here. We found ourselves a new location. That's soft intro, a little bit of privacy jazz, yeah, and then we're going right into it. Yeah,
right. Yeah.
And we got a number of people here that you have heard already. We have Gene, Steve, and Paul, which you have heard. Say hey, guys.
What's up, guys?
Hey.
Hello. Hello.
Yeah. And what was your name again? Wade. Wade. We got Wade too joining us.
I have a quick question, guys.
Yeah.
So one of the things about privacy in this day and age is we've been moving in the wrong direction, and the social pressure is move in the wrong direction, you know, just give up everything. I'm wondering for the people in this room how much you've like given into that and how much you've kind of resisted social media or other privacy mistakes.
That's a good question. I like that question. That's a good one to officially start this off, even though we've jabbered for like 15 minutes. Steve, did you jump in on that one?
I deleted my Facebook account about 2 years ago, like slowly, like getting away. I'm like a lurker. Oh no! I just signed up for another Tinder account.
There we go. The Grindr account too, probably. Okay.
One thing that crossed my mind just when we were just talking was, is there an overlap between like the new 1% of the world and like the people who care about privacy? Like, is it going to be that the top 5%, you think, like you said, there's only 5% of the people that care about privacy. Is this going to be like the new top 5% kind of? Like, is it important to become rich? Are you going to have to care about your privacy? But
that's an interesting question.
Isn't that a question? I didn't mean to take away from
goodness
that question. I've
been an employee my whole life, and that's kind of one of the biggest dangers of privacy, in my opinion, is just how that's the biggest place where they can get at you, is you're the most vulnerable with your income. You know, I don't know what they would hit you with. I mean, they used to be able to hit you for like gay marriage and stuff. So there's really no telling what sort of discrimination or that we necessarily move. Progress has to happen and not ever fall back.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, particularly when you're talking about like permissionlessness. Like, as soon as someone has the authority to start telling people who can transact and who cannot, or who should have privacy or who should not, who should have like their private endeavors protected and who gets exposed, like that authority gets used. Like it is kind of part of our human nature to, you know, when we feel justified in doing something, that we're going to do it, whether it's because somebody disagrees with me or, you know, whatever it is. So just having that avenue available to someone, I think, is dangerous. And like, that kind of goes right along with the idea of, like, of Steve, what you were saying was, do you think, you know, are we going to have this new world where like millennials just don't care about that? I think it'll be interesting to see maybe like what degree of pushback there is, but I think there is an overdue pushback. I think there are a lot of people who care who felt they just don't have the avenue yet to like privacy just has not really been a great option. Like, you know, their options are like really crap privacy or like pretty crap privacy. So, you know, they just make that choice, or they just like, well, I've already lost 90% of it. Why do I care about this last 10% kind of thing? And I think right now we are pretty apathetic about it. Like, I know I kind of am personally. Like, back to your question of like, I still have a Facebook account. I don't go on it hardly anymore. But I feel like with a podcast, like, I should like try to promote it. And I hate that I'm like logging back into it again because I despise Facebook. But there's so many times where I the privacy versus convenience. Like, I choose convenience because there is a lot of privacy invading stuff that is stupidly convenient. But I try to be very selective. I definitely do take my privacy where I feel like it matters. And I usually go overkill in those matters. Like, and not even because it's like, I'm not doing anything illegal, but there are just some things where I'm just like, you know, it is nobody's business, even if I'm doing something perfectly acceptable here. And I don't want to get myself in the habit of feeling like it's okay that other people are seeing that I'm doing this or that, particularly when it comes to like, we're moving into a world where digital keys are our value, are our identity. And I'm like, like, you know, at some point you have to draw a line. And I hope that line gets closer and closer towards privacy by default. And that's where I think millennials will land, is if the cypherpunks today, if the Bitcoiners, now that we have something truly of value, of billions of dollars in value, that we have to learn how to keep private, because of that and the fact that we have more cypherpunks today working on privacy tech than even seemed, it seemed hilariously infeasible just 10, 20 years ago, I think the millennials who are apathetic will end up with privacy apps without knowing or caring that they've got it back.
Where did that 5% number come from? Where 5% people, 5% of people care about privacy.
I think we just threw that out there. Okay. I mean, that's what
it's that realistic.
Just used it as an example.
Yeah, but it just seems like of my friends, like maybe 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 20 actually cares.
It could very well be lower or higher than that.
I think the convenience of privacy is. Like privacy as a service, like it's easy for me to download a VPN and there's at least a quick layer. It costs me $5 a month. So I could see that, or like scrubbing pictures off the internet. Like it costs a lot more money, but it's something that I don't necessarily know how to do, but I can pay somebody else to do it for me. So I see that as the next privacy as a service industry for Gen Z and millennials.
Yeah, but the incentive is still kind of tough because – you know, look at ad tech, the ad tech industry, right? With Facebook, Google, like they, you know, the big players right now, they're incentivized to limit privacy, right? Mm-hmm. But a cypherpunk, what is his incentive to like enforce privacy for others, right? There's not much.
Well, it's a dream.
Yeah, well, I guess as the true cypherpunk writes code that he gives to other people that allows those people to, you know, build their own privacy, right?
So like, sell to somebody else.
Yeah, sell it or give it away. Just a cypherpunk writes code to give people more privacy.
And he feels good doing that.
Yeah.
He
or she's like doing it good for the world, like kind of thing, I think, right?
Yeah. Cyberpunk is very much an ideological thing. Like it was birthed on the internet. Like the whole thing was about privacy. In fact, that was kind of one of the interesting things about the creation of Bitcoin, is even though it's not really a privacy technology, it's pseudonymous. It's like, so, you know, you're not registering for an account or to get an address, you know, it's all based on keys. But it was created in the era of, like, this was about making, you know, Chalmi and digital cash possible after like eCash and like DigiCash failed, like all these things in the 90s. Like this was a decade or two decades worth of like real solid, like a strict cryptographic community, and their goal was privacy. It ended up being Bitcoin that they created, which isn't really private, but the only reason is there is because they were all aiming for privacy.
Well, the only reason it's really not private is because we're dealing with KYC. We have to cash out
it's
somewhere,
integrated
right?
Into fiat. Now.
Yeah, we still love fiat. We're still tethered to fiat. So that's why we lose the true privacy piece of Bitcoin. If we were just using Bitcoin and maybe not too much face-to-face transactions, it would kind of be private to me. But I was going to say, going back to your question, Wade, with the, you know, just privacy in general, I think privacy itself is very expensive. For a norm, just for one person, it's so expensive from a monetary standpoint, an emotional standpoint, time. It takes a lot. Just try to take a home project, right, and just lock down anything that's talking to, like, Amazon in your home.
Yeah.
That's going to take a long time. You got to get, like, firewalls.
You got to know what you're doing, too.
You have to know what you're doing, right? Mm-hmm. You have to do a lot of stuff. Using the Tor browser, that's, like, people that know how to use it like efficiently, because some people use a Tor browser and they're still not really private.
Right? People don't know where they've given up their privacy when they're like going through exit nodes or whatever. Like,
people
make mistakes.
You can, and that's the thing. One mistake is so devastating when you're trying to be completely private. So from that standpoint, it's like, okay, it's so easy to just give it all away. Like the people that, you know, Snowden, that, you know, I think most of you probably watched the movie, his fiance who he was talking to, she was like, hey, I have nothing to hide, right? that's pretty much what people have to almost, you know, take by force. Like a millennial these days, they're like, okay, I'm growing up on Facebook and Twitter. I have to share. I have nothing to hide, and I actually have good things to share. Like, if I don't have good things to share, I'm a loser at this point. So I'm gonna keep sharing. So at this point, it's like, okay, the culture is actually going towards a direction where it's like, okay, if you're private, that's actually weird. That's really weird. So it's going to be a long battle, but I think over time, when people see the catastrophic losses they take when they put privacy into other people's hands, I'm not a fortune teller or anything like that, but it has to take catastrophic events to really change people's perspective on how to value privacy. So
yeah, I'd say to me, money is the most important thing where privacy matters. Like, I don't care too much about, you know, some device in my house recording stuff. I mean, yeah, it's important to maintain privacy for people that want it. But when I think of, like, the importance of privacy, the first thing I think about is just money and Bitcoin. And if we don't have privacy of financial transactions, then we don't have fungibility. And because people make blacklists or whatever. And so if we don't have fungibility, then we don't really have, like, sound money. So, yeah, like, privacy and, like, the social world, like, I'm kind of concerned in that. But I'm really only very concerned about privacy when it comes to the money part of it.
So the money piece, and I know Jared is here, but from the money piece, I'm going to spin this on you.
All right, yeah.
If it was truly fungible, what do you think about people that do really bad things in private with money?
Yeah, I've struggled with that. Like, that's a hard thing. When I was doing the radio show, in the first couple of shows, I was like, well, Bitcoin is actually more traceable than cash. You know, the authorities can use the blockchain to hunt down Bitcoin. But then after thinking, like, long and hard about this, like, I actually don't like that. Like, it's a hard thing, but I don't think you can have fungibility if you don't have total privacy. And because if we have identity attached to Bitcoin transactions, then people are going to make blacklists. And if you have blacklists on a money,
right,
then you don't have a fungible money. And if we don't have a fungible money, then this experiment's over. So it's kind of like, I have to just give up. It's one of those things where it's just like, hey, you got to, in order to have free speech, you know, some people are going to make terrorist plots or whatever, but you have to risk that bad stuff in order to have free speech. And I think you have to risk that bad stuff in order to have privacy.
So yeah. is it really that scary, though, to have a fully fungible environment? Like, I have never lived in a world where everything was fully fungible, but when everyone talks about it, I'm using absolutes, but not everyone, but when people talk about, hey, everything is fungible, everything is private, you have to worry about, like, people who are buying drugs on the black market or people buying guns, they can come and invade your home. But it goes back to the same thing, right? If everyone was private, don't you have access to the same weapons to defend yourself that these guys are buying, or drugs, or anything? I mean, you take matters into your own hands. I know this is getting a little philosophical and political in a sense, but I mean, that's kind of what Bitcoin is. Like, you got to start thinking about it in that way. But I think some people probably haven't even thought about a world where it was like completely, money was just completely fungible and private.
I think the trade-off is really clear. And I think we've already seen this debate. Like, I think it's scary in your imagination, like, because it's really easy, and, like, just as humans, like, we tend to imagine the worst stuff possible. Like, we're mostly negative as people, and I think that's a survival mechanism, you know? So it's really easy to imagine all the horrible consequences of, okay, everybody can have privacy. But, you know, they talked about all the horrible consequences of anybody can publish anything when the internet happened. But does the dark corner of 4chan, like, does stopping the dark corner of 4chan really justify, like, or outweigh the unbelievable benefit of having the internet? like, as a system. You know, like, yeah, there are consequences, but shitty people are shitty wherever they are. You know, like, it doesn't really, like, they're not going to really be enabled by the fact that, like, they can, like, have a private conversation. They really kind of always can. To some degree, someone who wants to be bad can always be bad. But, like, you see, like, these trends in kind of, like, a economic and political sense that the worst people, like, the people who are most resentful are bred in an environment where they're not given the freedom to express themselves. Like, so if we're giving up, like, yes, there will be consequences from fungibility of people who attack or try to use that against, like, someone in a very bad way. But I think you're going to produce less of those people in an environment where they're responsible for their own lives, where they are independent people who are given the default respect of being human and being alive and living their life. You produce fewer terrorists in a country with free speech. You produce terrorists very well in a country with unbelievable restrictions on what they can do with their lives, what they can believe, and who they can marry. That's how you make people suck. You produce an environment which makes people resentful of the world. And so I think Bitcoin being truly fungible, yes, it will have consequences, but I think a digital world where we are subject to someone else's control, where we are treated as dependents who cannot be trusted with the freedom to have a private conversation with someone, where we should not have privacy and like where we spend our money, will produce exactly the kind of people that will want to do harm to others. So I think it's a critical part of producing a moral society is privacy is an option. Fungibility is real in the money. And I think that's a really important part of this conversation. I think the trade-off is easily justified.
At the beginning of the podcast, you said that you think we will get privacy on the base layer. You think we'll get that through a soft fork? What are our options on the horizon?
I think the trade-off will be in cost. I think, like with Schnorr and Taproot and some of the technologies that are actually already on the horizon that have BIPs that are like right there, because block space and because like the block space, like just on chain in general, data is incredibly restricted, then it's about compressing that data as tightly as possible. And with signature aggregation and CoinJoin, when we have Schnorr signatures and those keys can be combined, like literally added together just into a single signature, then a CoinJoin transaction of 100 individuals or 100 inputs to 200 outputs or whatever it is becomes cheaper than individual transactions of one input to two output. And when that becomes the case, people will economically choose the version that has the best privacy or has sufficient privacy to make the currency fungible simply because it will save them money. And I think the more expensive block space becomes, the more aggregation will be important. And with cheap, easy, decentralized ways of like aggregating all of those signatures and transactions, like Wasabi Wallet, which, you know, does its job really well, I think that will simply become, that'll be the equivalent of data compression services on the blockchain.
So it'll look similar to the migration to SegWit addresses, that people are just moving to this to save money with the transaction.
Yes, that's kind of how I see it going.
I mean, with the coin joins, like, I feel like they're winning the race. Like, yeah. Wasabi and the guy from Samurai just open sourced that Dojo client, so, like, I feel like the people that are building the privacy tools, the cypherpunks, I feel like they're killing it right now. Like, I used to be worried about privacy on the main chain. I'm less worried now than I ever have been when it comes to that stuff.
Yeah, I'm right there with you.
Let's take a quick break, hit our sponsor, and then we will jump right back into this discussion all about privacy at the Raleigh Bitcoin Meetup.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a common saying in finance that, you know, you show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome. So I think we have to rely on the incentives that Bitcoin has to produce the outcomes that are ultimately going to hopefully be beneficial for the whole system. And privacy in the situation that you just described of CoinJoins and Schnorr and all these things that can help improve privacy and save users money in the and fees in the act, the incentives have to ultimately align to do these things and produce privacy, because in the long run, people are not going to do it if it's against their own incentive. So,
I mean, maybe we're just going to have like a few examples. Like, there's going to be some big news story about somebody who didn't take care of their privacy and then they paid the price for it, and then that'll incentivize people, maybe.
I think the pressure there is just a gradual step-by-step process. It's like one of those issues where, like, the more people become personally experienced with having their identity stolen, having to get a new credit card again because somebody in Canada tried to buy, you know, face cream with it. That's actually happened to me. A Beatrice in Canada tried to buy face cream on the internet with one of my cards, and I had just gotten
shout
a new
out
card
Beatrice
like 2 months. What's up, Beatrice? How you doing, girl?
It was an accident.
He's lying. It's actually him. He's Beatrice.
I was trying to maintain my privacy when I bought my acne cream. I had to get a whole new card to keep my privacy. But I had gotten a new card 3 months earlier. I remember because you could go on, like Torrance just had, I was trying to figure out where actually the leak happened. I finally found it in the PlayStation leak, the Sony leak that leaked like 9 million or whatever million users it was. I went looking, I was like, okay, I wasn't in there was that Home Depot leak, and I was like, okay, I wasn't in that window, and I actually went hunting through the main leaks to see where my new card, which was 4 months old, actually made it out into the world, and there was a torrent. I could just download the entire PlayStation 4, like, or the PlayStation Network leak, and I just did a simple Command F, searched my name, there I was, name, address, credit card number, and I was like, wow. And so got myself a new card and all that jazz.
Yeah, and stuff like this happens a lot. I mean, when the PlayStation leak happened, they didn't really announce it right away. So your stuff was in the wild for quite some time before they actually announced it. So imagine other companies like, what's the recent, well, one of the credit bureaus got hacked, right? Yeah, Equifax, right? And that's social security numbers, your past places you lived. So they can really, I mean, whoever gets that information, you're done. Like, there's no way you can really erase history of yourself. So you'd almost have to get a new identity if someone got you on Equifax, you know, data.
So, you also have to remember that information can sit there for 5 years.
Right.
And it's so many people, like, some of these things have 40 million users leaked and stuff. Like, there aren't enough criminals to go through that many, like, fake credit cards in a month, you know? 5 years later, you could get caught with the Sony hack just because some criminal just finally decided to pick your name out of the bunch to make the next credit card that they were trying to make.
Yeah, the Equifax thing was 155 million people.
Good Lord.
And the Target thing from a few years ago was like 40.
Yeah, okay.
The numbers are just insane.
Hilarious. Like, yeah. It's just like, if you're not assuming that your information is out there somewhere, then you're just living in fantasy land. Like, it's leaked so bad that the only reason that people have not had, like, identity theft is because it's like picking a needle out of a haystack. Like, you're just picking one of a giant batch of needles, and your only safety and privacy now is that nobody's looking for your particular needle, you know?
Yeah, and I think this goes to where efficiencies with, delegation goes wrong. So Equifax, 150 million, that's catastrophic, right? But imagine the employees that they had guarding that information. It's probably like a team of five, if even that many people. So, okay, let's go back to Bitcoin. One to one, right? One person to one wallet, you're responsible for your own wallet. Equifax, five people to 150 million people. That's bad math right there. Yeah. that's what we're dealing with right now. And events like that happening more often are you know, those are the catalysts to like a nice hyper Bitcoinization that we all want, right?
And then you throw in multisig and you've got more than one person per per address and wallet.
Yeah.
So
you've separated your single point of failure, like you've split it among multiple people. Even if you've got it like one to one addresses like all across Bitcoin.
Yep.
I wanted to ask, you guys mentioned somebody, I think you mentioned VPNs earlier. Who uses a VPN in here? We got three.
I do.
Three rays. Oh, I guess me too.
More than half the room.
Okay, so pretty much everybody.
Who uses it just because of BitMEX?
We will not say.
BitMEX brought me here.
All right, yeah. But what's funny is that, like, I one of my favorite things to do with my VPN is to browse the internet in my exposed identity, and then browse the internet behind the VPN. I know when I'm giving certain information out to the internet, and it's hilarious that the internet is a different place based on who it thinks I am. And that blows my mind. I will regularly jump countries in my VPN and research the same stuff in Google to find answers to questions that I can't find. Particularly political, it's insane. If you look up anything about American wars or like what's going on in the Middle East, it's nothing but positive. America is great, glorious. If it thinks I'm coming from North Carolina, that's what it gives me. If I log in from Sweden or Hong Kong, it gives me an entirely different story, an entirely different set of links with the exact same search. And I do that regularly to find like news reports, like, because if I'm going to read something or I'm going to look into something, like, I'm not going to get the New York Times version of that garbage. And like, so I'll regularly, that's my favorite thing to do with it, is just kind of see how the internet reacts.
You're getting better data.
Yeah. Oh, I'm getting way better data. Yeah.
Do you think that's like part of Google's PageRank algorithm? Like, people from this IP address range typically found this website more entertaining, or they stayed on that website longer, so we're going to just include that. So it's not like Google doing it like maliciously. It's just that's how the algorithm works.
No, yeah. I mean, it could very well be. Like, I'm not even saying that it is a malicious thing. I think it's the consequence of the fact that like people in America are more likely to read something that says America is great, and like people in, you know, halfway around the world are less likely to care about that. So like I'll regularly, like when I'm browsing the internet and I know my privacy is exposed, I get links and suggestions of stuff that I really want. Like, I like the ads that are catered to me, particularly like with electronics and stuff. Like, sometimes I'll find out a
face cream.
Well, face.
He likes that face cream.
The face cream is just for my Beatrice identity and nothing else. Okay. Face cream and clothes. That's it.
That is funny.
You're saying something. What you got?
Yeah, so, go ahead.
The system I've heard is that we kind of live in inverted totalitarianism, where we're all conforming by our own choice.
Yeah.
Like, it is nice when all of reality is distorted to match your views, the things you
it's
like.
Very comforting.
And we've all given up what we know is the objective reality is out there, and we're choosing to spend all our time in this one. And it's more seductive than reality itself.
Yeah, that's the thing with that makes social media so dangerous when it comes to privacy, is because we're creating our own echo chambers everywhere, right? Twitter, we follow the people that we want to hear from. Facebook, we follow all the people we want to hear from. Google, just going on the search console, right? We're searching and it's giving us stuff that it knows that we like. And that's the problem I have a personal gripe with AI in general, because that's the direction that they're taking AI. And it's not like they asked normies, you know, hey, what do you want from AI? You know, they didn't ask us that. They were like, okay, we're going to make some stuff where it's like, okay, we're going to give you more of what you want. Not knowing that might not really benefit me, right? That might not benefit me.
It's helpful
me
up to a point. And then it becomes a feedback loop where you're hearing mirror, mirror on the wall.
Exactly.
I'm the great, yeah.
And you're not growing at that point.
Exactly.
So yeah.
As soon as everything is designed to make you comfortable, you stop growing. It's amazing how much being uncomfortable and like being out of your element is a growing experience. Is how you learn. You know, anything you don't know is gonna be in your is out of your comfort zone. You know what I mean? It's interesting with that because be very quiet when we're opening our beer.
It's Bitcoin beer.
Yes, it's a Bitcoin beer.
It's a Keystone Light, by the way.
Oh, cool.
Send free, send Keystone.
I heard a interesting. You were talking about how like people create echo chambers and stuff online. I actually heard a really interesting. I watched first. It was a guy who used to work at Facebook, I think. It was like a 2-hour. They called it a documentary, or it was like 3 hours. They called it a documentary. It was a sit-down interview. It was not a documentary. Nobody edited that thing. But it was an amazing conversation. And the guy was talking about how the AI is designed to create conditioning. So, because their goal is to keep you on the platform. And one of the things that like something like Twitter does is that they particularly push controversial stuff or outrage type content in front of you, so that because anything that like just makes you happy and fulfilled makes you get up and want to walk away from social media. So it's being outraged. It's the troll culture. It's the enticing and like poking at people that keeps them staying and keeps them making comments and retweeting. So that these AIs have actually been designed to trap us into these little outrage echo chamber type things. But what's funny is, so there's definitely a huge part of like conditioning and like negative like consequences to this. But at the exact same time, I've watched a lot of stuff and like conversations and research on the amount of ideas that actually still cross community barriers, and that the net result of this is still ideas moving and mixing faster, as opposed to it seems like we're making echo chambers, but think of how horrible our echo chambers are in our physical world. I mean, we're all hanging out here because we're a bunch of Bitcoiners. I don't spend much time with no-coiners, you know? I have to physically go and talk to those people and be like, let's have a conversation. Our echo chambers in real life are horrible. They're only sort of bad on the internet when you think about it.
What do you talk about with no-coiners? Because I'm looking for topics.
They are for not
the weather?
Bitcoin. The weather. Some
looking for pickup lines.
No, I feel myself slowly separating, you know, from society, and I'm trying to be okay with that in a way. Like, you know, I truly believe like Bitcoin is going to be kind of the new world order in a way, and like the people that are into it now are going to be like the, you know, the new 1% or so. And it's like, I guess Bitcoin Meister calls it like the Bitcoin overlay. Like if you're in the Bitcoin, you're kind of in this like meta level on top of this society, because like the freaking form of money of our society is freaking changing. And it's like, I know this, but I can't really talk about it at length with like normal people, because then I can't have like a relationship with them. So I just have to like sit here in my parallel world and just watch this thing unfold, right? Yeah, does anybody else feel like that?
Absolutely. You can only bring up Bitcoin so many times with somebody who doesn't want to talk about it before you have to quit talking about it.
Yeah. That's where I think Facebook coin is interesting. It's forcing people into cryptocurrency. Like, in the future, I see people, they're still going to be using plastic cards, or they'll be using PayPal, but in the background, there's a base layer of Bitcoin. And not to say that they'll be able to understand what you're talking about, so it's I just see it as facilitating community and trying to infect more no-coiners.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I agree that Facebook coin is going to do more harm than, I mean, more good than harm, just because it's going to make people more aware of cryptocurrency. And like, you know, 5% of the people who hear about Facebook coin are going to dig deeper and go into Bitcoin. But I'm just so like underwhelmed by Facebook coin. It's just like, it's just not, it's going to be like, oh, okay, there's going to be a coin in your WhatsApp thing. I mean, I already send money with Venmo and Cash App to other people, and now I'm going to be able to send money with Facebook. Like, it's not, it's so not interesting to me.
It's backed by a basket of currencies. It's like, why?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
Yeah, it sounds like what the IMF has been trying to do for forever. And it's like, why would Facebook be in charge of that? But the, you know, the whole theory that Facebook is some sort of CIA, you know, thing.
It is. I'm sure the CIA has a login.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a tough one. I like where you're going though, because it does. It's overall, it's more good than harm. It's definitely still harmful. I think at the end of the day, when they came out and said that to run a node is $10 million, that's obviously.
Wait, is that true?
Yeah. Is that true?
Yeah. I thought that was $10 million
to run a node.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard it from multiple sources. Maybe it's a really good joke.
Is it a really good troll or is
Facebook.
It true?
Yeah. It's legit. Yeah. That's what they're saying. I mean, obviously, Zuckerberg hasn't came out and said that, but that's what the word is on the street right now. It's $10 million to run a node and be a, I guess, a node runner.
I can't wait for the day where one Bitcoin equals one Facebook node.
And at the end of the day, it's still a centralized currency that's backed by other centralized currencies, and it's. But it does introduce people to cryptocurrencies. People will dive deeper and they'll see, okay, there's something called Bitcoin out here that can really solve my particular problems. Because the problem is actually human beings themselves, like we're all not that great with dealing with just flat out 180 changes like that. Like someone who's been indoctrinated into a system where they've never questioned what the money source their money source is, they're not going to just on a whim, just accept Bitcoin. There's several stages. For me, honestly, it wasn't even about money. I got into this whole thing by looking at Ethereum because, you know, I'm a web developer. And Ethereum, I saw a YouTube video saying you can build indestructible apps with, Ethereum, right? Building dApps. I was like, oh, man, I got to build an indestructible app. And later on, I figured out that it was impossible to build an indestructible app on Ethereum. And I was like, okay, well, what's this Bitcoin thing? And then that blew my mind. But I'm not going to say never, but it would be highly unlikely for me to just be like, okay, what's Bitcoin? I like Bitcoin. That would have been my progression.
I'd like to take it back to privacy for a minute here and talk about the concept of, I'm sure some people here run nodes. I don't think everyone does, but I'm sure some people do. And out of the people that do run a fully validating node on Bitcoin, you know, there's
four hands on that one.
There's, yeah. And myself too.
Oh, five. We got five.
But, you know, I think there's somewhere around like 400 million transactions over the last 10 years on the blockchain. And out of those 400 million, there are surely horrible things that people have paid for with Bitcoin, murder and any bad thing you can think of in the world. Has absolutely been paid for with Bitcoin.
I bought a calendar from one guy one time.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
Yeah. Calendar purchases? No. That's at the top of the list.
That's a jab at me.
I heard he took all your information on his website and he's keeping your home address stored in his database.
I made him give me his social security number.
But just overlaying the concept of privacy on those transactions, because if it were up to me, you know, personally and ethically, I would not want those things to happen. But, you know, is Bitcoin the place to enact those things to keep people from doing things, or is it just government and police work and other areas of society that can stop those things, and, you know, church and other things that people like that make themselves moral, you know?
I feel like what you're saying is should the government put little tracers in the notes of the cash of the each paper bill? Like, is the solution to criminal activity to put these trackers in the notes? It's like, no. It's like, on that level, it's cash and it's fungible and it's private. And, like, the police work has to be done on a level on top of that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Because all those things that people are doing are already illegal, you know, so the laws don't stop them from doing it. The only way that we're going to stop people from doing these things on a prospective level is by making, you know, by trusting people and not wanting people to do bad things. But I just don't think that Bitcoin is the place to enact those types of privacy and regulation things.
Yeah, I think the externalities, like you have to remember what the consequences of doing that at a systemic level are. Like, okay, yeah, maybe you gain some partial ability. There's no way just because you've destroyed everybody's privacy or you've created some censorship in the base protocol, there's no way you're going to stop all criminal activity, because it would mean that you would have to know it's going to be criminal before the transaction happened. Right. So, like, not only are you not going to stop anything, but the consequences of that degree of centralized control are vastly worse than having to worry about somebody having, you know, some murder for hire or buying, you know, like, we're talking about the difference between, like, political and, like, societal level massacres. Like, when you have, like, systemic imbalances and vulnerabilities like that that get exposed by political authority.
So when I think we would all agree that that's making these things illegal doesn't stop them, because they were happening well before Bitcoin existed.
Like, so, does anyone think if you turned off Bitcoin tomorrow that crime rates would go down? Like, I've never heard anyone propose that idea, which is the idea that Bitcoin is dangerous, or
which
shut
is the
down,
presumption.
We'd
that's
all
the
be
presumption.
Safer.
Exactly.
If that's not true, then obviously it's not dangerous.
So it kind of begs the question of what's actually the motivation for trying to, you know, get rid of privacy on Bitcoin. Because if we all agree it wouldn't have any effect, then what's it really about? You know, is it just purely control?
Mm-hmm. I think it's control and the illusion of safety.
Security theater is a very profitable political business.
Yeah, I mean, like, companies like Enchain and whoever's doing, like, the blockchain analysis stuff, these guys are probably getting, like, millions of dollars from government agencies. So
good business.
Yeah, it's probably just the business incentive, I guess.
Yeah, as long as governments have immense purchasing power and their goal remains, somebody's goal will always be to keep someone else in line or control someone else. Like, that's kind of a consequence of being around other humans. And as long as there is all the dominant purchasing power and the ability to manipulate the money is in the hands of central institutions, that will be exposed, because they're the ones that would profit most in political control, in the ability to threaten or coerce people into doing certain things or to having their vision of the world implemented, as opposed to the people who are actually doing the earning and the building. As long as that avenue exists, it will be abused. So I think Bitcoin is a huge part of removing that avenue and making the exposure to that type of corruption as minimal as possible and as individual as opposed to systemic as possible.
So are you saying these people won't have jobs when Bitcoin takes over?
If they're not providing a service that people want, no, and they shouldn't. Like, if I'm just digging holes in people's yards that nobody wants, like, I shouldn't get paid for it.
Sounds like a lot of government jobs are about to end.
Probably. I wouldn't cry.
What do you guys think about privacy for entities that are not people, like corporations being able to do private transactions, or even countries being able to do private transactions? I know it's a geeky thing, but I really think it would be great if, just to see what it looked like, if you couldn't enforce trade sanctions because you couldn't censor money and see where it was going, what would the world look like in that scenario? At the same time, that's such a radical idea for the United States at this point in time, that you would just let countries not being able to be sanctioned or something that level of freedom.
Yeah, that was funny. That's something that Brad Sherman mentioned in the little speech he gave in Congress or whatever it was that he specifically said that, like, part of our power is in the fact that the U.S. has the money that people have to buy in order to get oil from the Middle East, and because we can implement sanctions on other people through control of our currency, and if people use something like Bitcoin, we won't be able to enact that control anymore. But I think it's an inevitability of the fact that there is any privacy at all. Like, if we have privacy on Bitcoin, then corporations will be able to have privacy if they seek it.
I think we talked about this before. There's multiple stages to this. I think Bitcoin is fighting it's kind of a development war at first, and then obviously, what do you call it, the integration piece. But then there's going to be a actual physical piece where right now the U.S. dollar, no one really knows what it's backed by, but it's really backed by military, our military strength in telling people, okay, you're going to do this because we'll beat you up if you don't do this.
Proof of violence.
Right, proof of violence, right? So, yes, even if Bitcoin does take over, there's still violence, right? There's still superpowers out here. So they can still enforce sanctions. But the thing is, how does Bitcoin, you know, screw that system up? Are they just not going to use Bitcoin? But there's still the United States. There's still China. There's still Russia.
I think you said it right there, like sanctions. Like you can't do sanctions anymore when you have Bitcoin. Like
makes it a very different problem.
Yeah, like the government imposes sanctions by the Visa network. I mean, that's like the mechanism by which sanctions are imposed, right? Like, Swift or whatever. So it pretty much
bank settlement, like it's all the financial networks, that, you know, cross borders.
I mean, I agree. I mean, it's not like Bitcoin's going to solve all the problems of the world. I mean, there's still going to be like wars. Okay, yeah, maybe it will.
that's what I'm saying. I think
a challenger on that point.
I think that stage is gonna. There's gonna be a stage where it goes to immediate like chaos and violence. Because when that does happen, when there's hyper Bitcoinization and people are like, well, countries are like, hey, we can use Bitcoin. We're not gonna use the U.S. dollar anymore. There's gonna be complete chaos, and there's gonna be a struggle. Even though the struggle is going to be for no reason because no one can really control Bitcoin like that. But there's going to be a struggle to figure out, okay, who's in control, right? And then when the dust settles, there'll still be Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think any transition period, like in how society organizes itself, has always been met with incredible violence. And Bitcoin is not a insignificant transition on that scale. Like anybody who really begins to see what money means to society, and like how we organize ourselves economically, like you begin to see what an incredible potential and like what a huge shift Bitcoin represents as a technology. Mm-hmm. But I think at the exact same time is even though like I think the violence is inevitable at the same time because it's also just acting as an escape valve on an imbalance that's already built. Like we were overdue for something anyway. It's just that Bitcoin is now actually a possible solution to this whole mess, whereas the imbalance and the violence has already been set. The stage has been set for 60 years. And we're finally reaching that point where debts are so massive that we can't prop up we can no longer prop up our currencies and the consumption of the first world by pushing the demand for our fiat currency onto the third, which is what has happened for a very long time now. And so I think that was inevitably going to come to an end because all the water is in one side of the bucket and it's got to rush back. So the fact that we have Bitcoin just means that the transition that was always going to be messy could actually be the new plateau for what our standard is could change in one of the most meaningful ways that we've seen in literally millennia. So I
don't think the future can possibly be American. If you look at the trend, it's either going to be Bitcoin or it's going to be China, who dictates like what the world looks like for the next century.
I agree. America is on its way down.
And Bitcoin sort of forces China to not even have that position anymore. It's not like China's going to overpower with their currency and their might. It's just going to be Bitcoin. I don't see countries really other than namesakes and smaller factions.
I mean, remember the Roman Empire. I mean, this happened with many empires, Byzantine, Roman, the Greeks, and even not just in the continent of like Asia and Europe and stuff like that, that region. There's always been a cycle where it becomes like these small nation states they group up, they aggregate, then they break up again. Then they aggregate again, break up again. I mean, just like you said, there's some imbalance stuff in people, just society in general. It goes through the cycles, basically, and that's what we're going through, and we'll see what Bitcoin provides.
I think we've got a better stage set for, like, I think the level of violence, just because of the exposure of the world today, because of the ability to quickly communicate, like, we get outraged over minor things now. Like our standard for what is horrible violence is drastically different, and the ability to keep a secret that is an evil, terrible secret has declined quite a bit. There's a great book called This Machine Kills Secrets, and it's all about, like, the birth of the internet and the cypherpunks and WikiLeaks and all of this stuff over a period of like 20 years, and kind of the telling the story of where leaks turned into like the exposure of information of like terrible things. So many people think the world is violent today, and it's just because we can now see it. There's always a picture of it. There's a video of it somewhere, when really violence is lower than it's ever been. Like, we see these tensions, we have these culture clashes, and like the violence is in front of us, but it's still the least amount that it's like literally ever been in any meaningful sense since the beginning of human history. Like, so yes, it will be messy, but I don't think it will be any disaster in comparison. In history, it will look like a Nerf war, you know? Hopefully, that's my optimistic view. I'm always like looking those bigger trends, and I just hope that it's just going to be a little blip on a chart that gets better and better looking.
Do you realize that like no one understands that libertarian and cyberpunk philosophy is about anti-violence? Like I was talking to my mom about this the other day, and you know, she's been like kind of liberal Democrat her whole life about like peace and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. Like most people like that don't know that the principle of nonviolence is the core principle of like Austrian economics.
Everything else is just derived. Like that's the only thing that even
that's
matters.
The only like, thing that matters. Yeah. But most people have no idea about that.
Yeah.
They have no idea that peace is the only real core principle.
Yeah.
They just think it's kind of like, oh, like libertarian, like selfishness, like that.
Yeah.
Like most people have no idea
about
that.
Don't take my stuff.
Yeah.
It's because nobody knows it because the libertarians don't force their point on people.
Right. Yeah.
Because we leave them alone.
Yeah. The Bitcoin's been lucky that it hasn't been politicized in this hyper-political environment. Yeah. Like, the worst smear that you could give to Bitcoin would be, like, to say it's a Democrat thing or a Republican thing. Because suddenly half the world's not going to look into it. They'll just hate it for that mischaracterization, you know?
Yeah. As soon as it's got a Confederate flag on it, it's like, well, when we're just, let's just get rid of Bitcoin. We're done with that.
Oh, something else that popped into my head. I was listening to a podcast today. I can't remember which one it was, but it was like, it's worth noting that that privacy is possible as demonstrated by Satoshi. Like, this guy has remained anonymous for 10 years, like with the entire world trying to track him down. I think it's cool. I mean, of course, like you said, it's a lot of hard work, but it's cool that it is possible, except for the fact that Satoshi's not human, so it's possible for the alien AI.
Oh, you're in the alien bank. AI.
Obviously, the aliens traveler. Know how to stay private
exactly,
on the internet.
Right.
Duh. Oh, maybe we shouldn't get into this. Maybe we should leave this for another episode when we do this. But can we all just like appreciate how fantastical and perfect the story of Satoshi and the fact that we don't have any idea who it is? Is like just the kind of the cinematic beauty of the fact that that's actually how it happened, and that's it was actually the cypherpunks, and like that's just kind of how it came into being. Like very rarely in the world does something line up so thematically with the events that actually made it, you know. We usually have to manipulate the narrative a lot to try to make it fit, and that one just kind of was.
So, you know, when we describe why there can never be another Bitcoin because of the Immaculate Conception, I don't think people really realize how amazing that was. Like, all of the weird kind of private, kind of grassroots, kind of like all of the strange things that happened in the beginning, like there's no way that's reproducible now. So there, I mean, maybe there will be, you know, maybe Bitcoin won't work for some reason, but like no coin that is like generated now can ever have the kind of birth that Bitcoin did.
Yeah.
Like definitely.
I think it was actually 21 Lessons that I just read. He talked about the
that
narratives.
Was awesome, by the way. Everybody needs to check out Crypto Economy's 21 Lessons podcast, because that thing was freaking off. Did you listen to that one? That one was awesome.
Oh, yeah. It's by Dergigi on Dergigi. You can find that on like Dergigi.com. And I think he was going to post the audio on his website soon. But it was so much fun to read. He has a lot of great like Alice in Wonderland quotes. And it's 21 lessons that he learned tumbling down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. And one of them is about like narratives. And there's a couple other pieces. And I haven't yet read Dan Held's Quantum Narratives, but that's another really good article on it. And it's just talking about how like the origin story is so important for people understanding the meaning of something. And so like the natural marketing, the truth of Bitcoin is the most epic of origin stories that could be. It doesn't even have to be marketed or manufactured. It just is.
Even the pizza story is such a ridiculous like fable of the guy who like gave up millions and millions of dollars for a slice of pizza.
Yeah. I love that. I love it.
I mean, but that guy is like killing it, by the way.
Yeah, Laszlo has
no problems. Laszlo's got
Laszlo's
no problems.
Good to go.
And also, somebody had to make transactions in order to demonstrate to the world that it was capable of transactions.
Well, nobody ever talks about that person.
Yeah.
The guy who got the 10,000.
Yeah. Well, the fable teaches the lesson, never sell your Bitcoin, which is exactly the lesson everyone needs to hear, you know?
Oh, man. Does anybody, we ran hella long. Does anybody got something they want to add? Got some final thoughts?
I mean, I don't know if this is a final thought. Maybe we can save this for another time, but what you're just saying, like, about, like, the transactions, one concept that continually blows my mind is that a money, if it's really good at transactions, will never be used for transactions because people are always going to spend the bad money. People are never going to spend the better. So the better a money is at transactions, the less transactions will happen. I think that's like one of these many paradoxes. I'd like to do that. I'd like to do a podcast in the future on just like all the paradoxes that you just have to kind of sit with Bitcoin. And I think the whole like Gresham's law about people spending bad money, Bitcoin will never be the currency that is used the most in transactions because it'll always be the best money at transactions,
which means
it'll never be used.
Yeah. Because it's the best money, because it's the one that like the goal of money is to store value across time. So the most scarce, the best money is the one that people will tend to hold for time. Like they see that as the value of time. So they're going to use the whatever shite alternative there is to transact because they're going to want to hold the one that's best.
The one that's best. But the one that's best, it has to be proved to them that it is capable of very good transactions. Yes. Yeah. So its transactions properties are really important to demonstrate, but it's because it makes it a good money. So it's kind of like, I don't know. Yeah. It's one of those paradoxes.
Ownership has to be exchangeable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fascinating. There's a lot of paradoxes in Bitcoin.
We talked about privacy and never brought up privacy coins. Like that's how big a topic it is.
That's a good question. Oh man. Yeah. How did we not get there?
I thought about bringing it up, but honestly, they seem a little redundant and unnecessary at this exact point in time. If we go through a cycle where they could matter again, but at least right now, I don't think they matter as much as they did 2 years ago even.
Yeah. That's interesting. I always had like just the idea that there's like novel privacy technology and novel transaction systems, I think is fascinating. I follow a lot of them. And like just the idea of censorship is an interesting thing when you're talking about a coin where you can't tell one transaction from another. You know, like what's the, you know, do you do a 51% attack to censor when you can't even know which transaction you're trying to censor? So there's a lot of really great things, but if none of them, like I think in the end, the trade-off of ensuring that we weren't relying on cryptography for the accounting side of things, I think was the better trade-off, because it means that we always have a hard money and the option of privacy rather than some sort of system like Mimblewimble, which as brilliant of a technology as it is, if the cryptography is ever broken, no one can see where the fake coins are. Like the whole thing just dies as soon as the privacy goes, because you can't prove the accounting anymore. So I think all of those privacy coins and stuff are really interesting, and I watch them closely, but I kind of think as a money, they're redundant. They're just fascinating technology.
I will say this, that like, I can't give legal advice like some people in this room, but if you care about somebody, don't let them buy anything illegal with Bitcoin, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that is some straightforward advice. Don't use Bitcoin for shady stuff.
I think it's interesting how quickly millennials and Gen Z are just on the internet, and they don't even understand the implications of buying something illegal. So they're going to go online, buy a fake ID, and that's it.
Yeah,
you know, no big deal.
When you're a kid, you know, it's like you get your friend to copy your CD, or you know, you buy a fake ID from the kid in the high school that's selling fake IDs. It just seems
it's natural,
arbitrary.
It's like, your parent, your
it's
government,
just like you're a kid. You hit the mailbox with your baseball bat, and exactly. So like you fool around like when you're a kid. So. Like, yeah, they don't realize.
They're breaking the law without even knowing it.
Yeah,
they're just buying a fake ID.
They don't realize the long-term consequences when it's being recorded and it'll be there forever type thing.
Mm-hmm. I like privacy coins. Like, I like what they're doing. I don't really think they're going to win for two reasons. One is that I think this coin join stuff on the base layer that we talked about before with Bitcoin, I think that's just going to go, like, bonkers. And that's just going to win the privacy stuff. And the other thing is kind of related to what Gene was talking about earlier. In order to really use a privacy coin privately, you have to VPN, you have to run Tor, you have to be like, it's like, if you're interested in a privacy coin, you can't just like log in from your home computer and use a privacy coin. So it's like all the things you have to do in order to be private. If you're already doing those things, then you're probably private on Bitcoin. You know, so it's just like the small fraction of people that they...
It's one attack vector of many.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think privacy on the base layer of the Bitcoin is gonna win that race. But that's not to say to stop developing them. Like, yeah, go at it.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, these guys that are developing altcoins that are private-based, they shouldn't stop, like you said. But just the past experiences with private coins haven't been that great. So we can take, you know, numerous examples like Bitcoin Private and Monero can even be used. I mean, Monero, they try to go with the whole ASIC resistant type of standpoint, and that completely crushed them. They had to completely fork into like a different version. No one knows what's going on at this point. I guess they kind of settled it out, but
that was so disappointing.
These are crucial mistakes. Bitcoin Private, you know, someone generated just basically was printing money behind hidden addresses. So they were using privacy against it. Their own users, in a sense. It was terrible.
That was the thing, is their Bitcoin Private was what allowed them. They thought they were going to get the benefit of having the hidden accounting so that they could create a back door. Was it like 300,000 coins or something? I can't remember exactly what it was.
It was enough to break them.
Yeah, it was enough to finally be revealed.
Yeah. all the Zcash derivatives are probably scams, mm-hmm. Zclassic and such, and all the Dash derivatives, including Dash, are scams.
Yeah, I mean, the Zcash themselves, privacy is not enabled by default with Zcash. And the Zcash developers don't even recommend you using the actual, the Z addresses or the really, because they're like really expensive to do anyway. So, I mean, everyone is trying to hop on the bandwagon and say like, hey, we have a privacy-based coin to I guess, you know, attract users, but we're dealing with money. Like Steve, you would say like, we're dealing with money here. This is people's money. We can't play around with that. And if you go through the route like an Ethereum or a startup where you're, you know, bringing stuff up and tearing stuff down, but this is people's money at stake, that's no good. So.
All right. Well, does anybody else want to add anything? Want to shill stuff that we're working on? I know
to the moon.
Some people. To the moon. Anybody got? We got Tim here. Tim with his paywall.link. He's been, just been sitting in the back, giving a raised hand every once in a while.
Thank you for the free show.
Anybody listening to this in Raleigh, like this is what the meetups are like. Like they're awesome. So just come out and join us.
I'm going to shill bitand.io. So if you want to look at a nice list of the daily listed cryptocurrency releases every day, go to bitand.io. So it's bitann.io.
I'm gonna shill this house. This is
oh yeah, that big thanks to Paul for like having this house for us. Paul, thank you, man.
You're welcome. Yeah, so we have a Bitcoin collective here. We're hoping to bring some people out. If you want to come here and work on a project, 15 South Bloodworth, you can also email me at bitcoinpup@gmail.com.
Sweet. And what's the actual name of, is this the Triangle Bitcoin Meetup? Is that the one on Meetup?
So there's a lot of Bitcoin meetups.
There's
the Triangle Bitcoin Meetup, which is Thursday nights at the Marriott. Okay, my Raleigh Bitcoin Meetup, which has been on Monday nights. Maybe we'll start doing that here now. Yeah. Paul made a meetup called the Bitcoin Collective. There's also a monthly Triangle Bitcoin Meetup that meets every first Saturday of the month at Lone Rider Pub out on Glenwood at 2 p.m. And then there's this kind of business and blockchain meetup that was going like every Tuesday of the month, but they haven't
Is that happening?
Haven't been doing that recently. Okay. But
I'll try to put links. I'll see if I can't source all this. I'm probably in all of those groups because if there was a group that said Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, I just added. So I'll see if I can't like piece all of those together and get links for anybody. Because I imagine I've probably got a couple of listeners who are out here in this area. I mean, I found out the number of you guys are listeners.
Definitely, yeah.
So yeah. We'll see if we can't get some more people out.
Just want to shill Bitcoin.
Shill Bitcoin. Guys, buy Bitcoin. Love it. All right, guys. Well, this was awesome. Thank y'all.
Thanks to Jared.
Thank you, Jared, the sound guy. We got to throw some props out. He's been working hard on the computer to make us not sound like idiots.
You haven't heard it yet.
Yeah. All right, guys. I think we're good, though.
Awesome.
All right, guys. Let me know what you thought of that episode. We had a lot of fun doing that, and I definitely want to do it again. We have a little chat going, trying to figure out what topics we want to hit. And a huge thank you to Steve, Wade, Gene, Paul, Daniel, Jared for doing the sound, and all the other guys for being moral support and the tons of great questions and little comments for putting up on the board. And that we kind of did that. Somebody just did that on the fly. That was actually really great to have. It was a good idea. Let me know what you guys thought of this episode, and don't forget about the Ask Guy episode that we got coming up. Again, that's going to be next Wednesday, so shoot me some questions for that. I'm going to have a place specific on the website to make that really easy. But for now, you can just shoot me a message on Twitter, leave me a voice message on Anchor. That's a really good one to do just because I can actually use the audio in the Q&A, which I think could flow really good. But also, obviously, just leave me a comment, suggestion, anything. This is a great way to get in touch with me, and it's a good opportunity to get me to answer a question or a comment or something directly. So I really want to test this out. I hope you guys join me for that. With that, though, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at TheCryptoEconomy. Don't forget to check out the meetup. There's the Bitcoin Collective that Paul is doing. And he's got that new place that we're setting up at. It's kind of an incubator, and we got a lot of people doing a lot of things. It's really exciting, and a thank you to him for the space again. But if you're in the Raleigh, North Carolina area, if you happen to be around, come hang out. We got a lot of meetups that we do. We got that one every Monday that we hit, and it's a great time. We just talk Bitcoin and, you know, shoot the shit. So definitely come out. Let's see, anything else to cover? Got the Ask Guy episode. Follow me on Twitter at The Crypto Economy. Check out the meetup. Yeah, I think we're good. I think we close this one out for the day. All right. I will catch you back here tomorrow when my voice causes me less pain, and I will be coming at you from the Bitcoin Blanky Fort. This is Guy Swan signing off. You've been listening to the Crypto Economy Podcast. Until next time, take it easy, guys.